Good morning, Mr. Kaisho.
I'm not sure what's happening.
Recording in progress.
1 minute to go, sir.
Sorry?
I'm saying there's 1 minute to go, but the chairperson did enter.
Oh, okay. Oh, my.
Morning.
Yeah.
Morning, Comrade Vic.
Morning, Honorable Tandy.
I wish I can change my life. I'm a nigga. I'm a nigga. We're meeting. There's a shutdown in Amanzi, Hillbron, because they want to buy. So we owe 67 million. I am just called by another principal of one school. It's Abandon. Kutakuna Manzi. So the challenge, I'm trying to organize the track. And umajoro wam kawunzima ke uswitcha off iphone. So you can't even talk to the leader. I don't know bathatha njani as positions bangafuna ukuphangela. We vala kanjani, we drop kanjani phone ukufonela.
Yeah, it's bad.
Okay. And she also takes gossip. When somebody lies to her about
abantu.
Morning.
It's a sekaya. So you
yo, zinzima, anji vile ngupa.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair.
I think it's we can start now. Mabani.
Yes, Darren on the floor.
Good morning, Chair.
Darren is the pilot today. Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Darren. Good morning, honorable members, our support staff, members of the public on the platform, members of the media. You are all welcome to this meeting. Again, this is a follow-up to the budget which was presented by the Minister of Finance. And as you know, as he presented that the budget, amongst the bills that he presented, was the Division of Revenue a Bill 2024, Second Adjustment Appropriation Bill 2023-24, and the Gold and Foreign Exchange Contingency Reserve Account and Defrayal Amendment Bill. Those bills were tabled by the Minister of Finance. So what happens after that is that these three bills were referred to us for consideration, at least for now. There's also an appropriation bill, which was also referred to the Standing Committee on Appropriations. So we've got three bills that we are dealing with. So today we've invited the Parliamentary Budget Office to come and share their thoughts about these bills as an independent body, which advises the portfolio committees, especially those dealing with the finances. So, Dr. Janchis and your team, you are most welcome to our meeting. And again, thank you very much for availing yourselves. So before we proceed with our the presentations, can I check whether we do have any apologies, Darren?
Chairperson, no, we didn't receive any apologies for today's meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Then let's go to the next agenda item. Honourable members, this is a presentation by the PPO. Doc?
Good morning, Chairperson.
Yes, you have got an hour to finish your presentation. Quite generous, eh?
I think the Standing Committee of Approval is always generous to us, and we really appreciate that opportunity, you know. And thank you once more. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, colleagues. Thanks so much for the opportunity, Chair. Thank you so much. I'm using two gadgets, so I'm having a problem with my gadgets now. So I'll try it. I'll be moving around. I'm with the team on the platform. I'll take the committee through the introduction, background, and the team will come in, and I'll come in at the end of the day, at the end, to do the conclusion remarks as well. Thank you so much. This is the presentation outline. And really, you are correct. We build up from the discussion that started by the Minister of Finance 2 weeks ago. There's a presentation outline that we have. We can go to the next slide, Kundi. I think in this introduction slide, just emphasizing, as the chair was saying, what we're looking at. But I think our presentation really looks at also the socioeconomic and service delivery situation in the context of the budget we presented. So that's to provide more context as well. We also do provide a bit of background around the three spheres. Our focus will be division of revenue and the second adjustment, but also on the gold reserves deal as well. But we look at situation analysis around the spheres of government, look at how revenues raise, but also we provide a bit of projections of how we see the budget impacting the socioeconomic situation, but also look at some of those other issues as noted in the slide. The next slide, Mukundi. I think what we want to also start by doing, Chair and members, just to remind ourselves by just going to the next slide, Mukundi, where we remind ourselves the role of these spheres of government, that national and the provincial government have a concurrent responsibilities for a range of sorts of services, where you see a lot of these allocations really around supporting these spheres of government realizing some of these services. In particular, with the national government having a very important role around leadership and policy formulation and providing oversight and monitoring the implementation of the policies in that regard. And the provinces, a lot of it is to implement these frameworks, these policies that are at a national level, but also a national executive responsible for some of the national responsibilities in that regard. So when we look at this division of revenue, we look at it within this context. Next slide, Mkundi. And for also we also look at the provincial and local spheres as well, where they receive such a chunk of the division of revenue to deal with those specific co-occurring functions, but also those specifically related to those specific spheres. We look at those, and then that context matters, because when we look at the budget in our analysis, Chair members, we look at from this context of this what needs to be talked about in that regard. Next slide, Kundi. And in this slide, we also remind that bulk of the revenue being allocated or divided between the three spheres is largely raised at the national level. And of course, provinces in particular have limited abilities of raising revenue, but the bulk of the local government has an opportunity to raise more revenue. But again, we've spoken about how that framework has worked over time, and it has enabled many of the municipalities, or it has made it difficult, particularly those rural and municipalities which are unable to raise revenue, particularly considering where we are at this stage. Now, the next slide, the next two slides, I just want to spend a few moments there as well. In our presentation on the fiscal summary last week, we did provide a status on government's NDP realization targets, but in particular how far government has gone, but in particular look at economic growth, unemployment, poverty, and income inequality. And I think in the presentation, Chair, members will remember we raised concern about the slow progress of achieving this target, and we further raised concern that the midterm, the 2024 budget process are unlikely to make very significant improvements in realizing these targets. So what we do today, Chair, I would like to share with the members of this committee our MTF projections outcomes based on the budget proposals baseline in particular. And we start by looking at economic growth and compare projections, our projections, with those of the National Treasury and Reserve Bank. And the people projection shows that the GDP outlook over the MTF is significantly raised, lower than the NDP targets in particular, but also the concern that it's inadequate. And we look at our, you know, we're saying 26, with our growth expectations from these proposals will be a slight 1.7%, which is slightly lower than what government is proposing. But I think the important message is still significantly below the 5.4% required by the National Development Plan. And by 2026, we'll be 4 years down the line, our NDP. So it's very important to really take this into consideration. There's insufficient support for economic growth development in particular. Hence, in our projection, we're able to show that the world growth will only go so much, will not go far than where we want to take, where the NDP requires to be. Our economy remains extremely concentrated in particular and highly, very highly financialized. The infrastructural economic transformation rather than the fiscal consolidation approach that we've taken, we believe is more required to get us to where the NDP required to set out ourselves to be. The budget could contribute towards achieving inclusive growth by really ensuring the sustainability, by ensuring that more support is given to the economy and households in particular. Next slide. I think the previous slide was very focused on economic growth. Our projections around, our initial projections around the economic growth based on the base budget baseline. And then this slide focused specifically on unemployment toward an inequality slide. And I think in line with the previous slide, our initial projections does show that we remain quite way off the mark in terms of realizing the NDP target when we look at the budget baseline. And based on this budget, our projections, our projection shows unemployment is projected to come down slightly to 30%, but remains way higher compared to the current 32.4%, but it still remains quite higher than what we want it to be and what needs to be done to get it down as well. It's a very important consideration that we're trying to emphasize in this regard. So at 2026, we expect it to come slightly 30% in our projections compared to what it is now. But again, 4 years down the line, NDP, a lot has to be done to try to ramp it up to where we want to be. Inequality, income inequality as well, expect to come slightly down to 72.7 points there compared to where it is now in 2026 and still slightly higher or even higher than what the NDP has proposed as well. Poverty levels would remain quite in the same range where we are now in 2026 compared to where we are now sitting at 44.9, expected in our projections to be sitting at 43.1 in particular. And I think these projections do show that more government intervention is required in the economy if NDP has to be realized in particular. And also, as I said earlier on, this is really setting a context in terms of, is this division of revenue and appropriation proposals enable to get government, and these are very important tools, police tools, government issues intervene in the economy. And that's really a context that I want to set out for the discussion in this regard. I'll stop there, Chair, and give the context of more details in this analysis, and I'll come in later to the conclusion. Thank you so much, Chair and members. Kagiso, are you the one who's coming next? Thanks.
Dr. Yankees, good morning and thank you, honourable members and other stakeholders on the platform for allowing us the opportunity to take you through the presentation. Next slide, please. The 2020s can be viewed as a period that has been overwhelmed by crisis. We have the COVID-19 pandemic, climate change shocks, and the cost of living crisis that has negatively impacted households. Underpinning the cost of living crisis in South Africa is an economy that continues to suffer from high unemployment, inequality where there's a high concentration of low-income earners along a few high-income earners, and pervasive poverty. I'll take the next point in the next slide, please. The annual average cost of household food basket increased by 64% from 2019. That was 3,103 in 2019 to 5,098 in 2023. The average cost of household food basket is above the 2023 average national minimum wage of general workers, which is 3,993 in real terms, and the average monthly social grants for 2024-2025. Social grants have been an essential safety net for many poor individuals and households. In the budget 2024, the National Treasury has allocated 33.6 billion rand for the COVID-19 social relief of distress grant for 2024-25. There's a decrease from 36.1 billion rand allocated in 2023-24 and the 33.9 billion rand, which is noted as a revised estimate. The monthly grant of 350 rand that will be received by beneficiaries falls short of the inflation-adjusted national food poverty line, which stands at 760 rand per person per month. Next slide, please. Amid extremely high levels of poverty, inequality, and unemployment, grants have supported the livelihoods of the most vulnerable. According to StatsSA, after salaries, grants were the second most important source of income for households in 2022. I'll take the next point in the next slide. With the number of people experienced hunger increasing from 6.5 million rand in 2018 to 7.8 million rand in 2022, social grants have contributed to improving food security for many poor households. The government social security system remains a vital intervention to fight the effects of poverty and to increase economic activity. In budget 2024, funding for COVID-19 SRD grant for the next 2 years after this financial year is only provisionally allocated pending a decision of its continuity and funding sources beyond March 2025. Next slide. I'll hand over to my colleague.
Thank you, Kagiso. Honorable members, in terms of economic security, the extreme levels of structural unemployment and inequality has depleted the resilience of the majority of the population. We note that the country's average annual unemployment rate increased from 27.3% in 2018 to 33.2% in 2023. The latest SSA unemployment figures show that unemployment stood at 32.1% in the fourth quarter of 2023. Youth unemployment in South Africa is quite concerning. We see that in the fourth quarter of 2023, the youth unemployment rate grew from 43.4% in the third quarter to 44.3%. And this translates to 4.7 million unemployed youth in South Africa. Next slide, please. In terms of justice and protection services, we see that there has been an increase in the number of crimes reported, and we see that between 2018 and 2022, violent crimes increased by 6%, while murder and attempted murder increased by more than 30% between the two periods. On average, year-on-year crime increased by 2.65% between December 2022 and December 2023. And if you look at the table on your right, you will see that crime detected as a result of police action also increased by 10.8% in this period. In 2022-2023, there was one police officer for every 417 people. And this, of course, excludes administrative staff. And as previously noted by the PBO, that this ratio is higher than the recommendations from the United States. However, it should be read in a context of high crimes in our society that are driven by a number of socioeconomic factors. We note that the 2024 budget is silent on the implementation of the National Strategic Plan on Gender-Based Violence and Femicide. We also note that an additional 350 million has been allocated to police and defense to support the upcoming elections. Next slide, please. In terms of higher education, inequality in access and quality of education is an important contributing factor to inequality in South Africa. This disparity in educational opportunities is evident for tertiary education, but is especially unequal for tertiary education. We note that progress has been made in the broadening access of education. However, intense disparities still exist. And if you look at the graph on your right, you'll see that enrollment at higher education institutions in 2022 was most common amongst Indians at 19.6% and whites at 17.7% for persons aged 18 to 29. And again, by comparison, you will see that this graph also shows that only 5.2% of colored and 5.5% of black population groups were enrolled in institutions of higher education. We note that of the 480.6 billion allocated to learning and culture in 2024 budget, 30% is allocated towards post-education and training. We also note that as at the 21st of January 2024, NSFAS had received more than 1.5 million applications for the 2024 academic year. Next slide, please. I'll now hand over back to my colleague Kagiso to take you through the remaining slides. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lazikazi. Yes. According to Statista, the percentage of individuals who attended primary or secondary school declined between 2018 and 2022. This trend poses a concern as the battle to strengthen the outcomes of the country's education system is usually lost or won at primary school. The other types of institutions that declined in terms of attendance between the 2 years was preschool attendance and TVET, whilst there was an increase in attendance for higher education institutions and other colleges. In budget 2024, of the 480.6 billion rand allocated to learning and culture, 68% will be going towards basic education. Next slide, please. I'll take these points on the next slide, please. We wanted to illustrate the composition or the situation of the public health workforce with the data and information that we could obtain. On your left-hand side, you have a table that shows how many doctors, nurses, and other health workers there were per 100,000 population as provided by the Department of Health. Apologies for the sourcing error. And then on your right-hand side is an analysis that was conducted by Mutlakhabo Maseke on the number of healthcare workers that were registered and those that was employed in the public sector. Staying on the graph, a total of 43,901 medical practitioners were registered in the Health Professions Council of South Africa by the 1st of April 2020, of whom 20,926, that's about 48% to be precise, were employed in public health sector. There were 285,245 nursing practitioners registered, while 143,288 were in the medical sector. Do please note that as with similar studies of this magnitude, there are some data limitations. In terms of the table on the right-hand side, according to an analysis that was conducted by the Department of Health, there were a total of 43 doctors per 100,000 population and 282 nurses per 100,000 population in 2019. In February 2024, Minister Joe Pasha revealed that 694 newly qualified medical doctors hadn't found jobs in public sector since qualifying at the end of 2023. National Treasury has allocated 271.9 billion rand towards health for 2024-2025. My colleague will touch on this a little bit further, but we have noted that the real per capita spending on health, however, declines over the interim period. National Treasury has proposed additional spending of 18.6 billion rand in 2024-2025 to pay the salaries of not only just nurses and nurses and doctors, but also police, teachers, and many other public servants. Next slide, please. Local government is a sphere of government that's closest to the people and has an important function in providing basic services to communities. The provision of municipal service is not only an important building block towards achieving inclusive, sustainable developmental goals, but it's also an effective form of public intervention to promote economic growth. The National Treasury 2022 State of Local Government Finance Report found that 169, which is about 66% of municipalities, were in financial distress at the end of 2021-22. According to a report by the Auditor General, only 38, which equates to about 15%, out of 257 municipalities achieved a clean audit in the same year. Government has made progress towards providing households with some access to basic services. However, the provision of quality service has been slow, and in some instances, it has deteriorated. The figure above shows that the number of people without access to water, sanitation facilities, and refuse disposal has increased, while those without access to electricity has declined between 2018 and 2022. Next slide, please. By way of background, the policy approach to basic services since 1994 has been that government funded the capital cost of new service infrastructure, while users covered operation and maintenance costs. However, the approach proved untenable because it was clear that poverty, unemployment, and high rent costs meant that poor people who constitute a substantial part of the population could not afford these charges. Therefore, in 2001, South Africa adopted the free basic service policy to provide free basic services to poor households. However, millions of South Africans eligible for free electricity services have not been getting them due to onerous registration processes, amongst other factors. In 2018, our calculation shows that only 3.2 million South Africans out of 10 million poor households were able to access free electricity. The figure above further shows that fewer households in 2021 are receiving free basic services. Next slide. I'll hand over to my colleague.
And thank you, Kagiso. Next slide, please. Members, the Division of Revenue Bill provides for the equitable division of nationally raised revenue between the three spheres of government. The diagrams below show the actual outcomes in 2021-22 and 22-23 of the estimates for 23 and 24. As previously also noted, government aims to increase the proportion of transfers to the provincial and local spheres of government, but outcomes are always slightly lower. The division of the 2024 revenue is national is receiving 48.5%, provinces 41.7%, and local government 9.7%. Next slide. Members, you are also familiar with this slide, and it is just a reminder that reallocation of funds is primarily from equitable shares and conditional grants in the community and economic development functions towards other function groups for compensation of employees. Next slide. In terms of the appropriations, on a national level, departments are estimating to spend 31.3% on current items and estimate to transfer 67.9% of the national allocations. In 2024-25, two amounts are allocated towards financial transactions in assets and liabilities. The 850 million is to purchase equity in the African Development Bank, and the 204 million is towards civil aviation. The last column shows the percentage change from the current financial year. Next slide. Members, changes to conditional grants transferred from national departments from the current financial year to the 2024 financial year are shown in the yellow column. The biggest reduction of 22.8% and 25% is in the public works and infrastructure for provincial and local government conditional grants. The biggest increase of 20.4% is towards local government from transport. Next slide. So members, in terms of the equitable share, the average annual growth in provincial equitable share over the 2024 medium term is 3.9% versus the previous estimate of 3.3% over the 2023 medium term. The increase from 2023-24 to 24-25 is, however, only 2.6%. In addition to the provincial equitable share to provinces, and they also receive conditional grants amounting to 129 billion, which brings the total allocation to 729 billion in 2024-25. Next slide. Specific changes to provincial allocations are the shifting of the maintenance and subsidy for nutritional support portions of the ECD grant to the national department. Funds for the health, human resource and training grant are shifted to the Eastern Cape, Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Northern Cape and Northwest, meaning that other provinces must cut on the training of health science professionals, including specialists, registrars, their supervisors, internships and community service posts. The human settlements development and informal settlements upgrading partnership grants also decline over the 2024 medium term. Next slide. Members, an interesting inclusion in the 2024 budget review is the illustration of the change of the division of revenue when own revenue raised by local government is included in the 2022-23 financial year. The result is local government share changed to 28% of the total government revenue versus the 8.7% without the municipal revenue. Next slide. Allocations to local government decreased by 20.6 billion over the MTEP. Direct transfers decreased by 13.5 billion over the medium term period, of which 9.6 billion is from the equitable share and 3.9 billion from conditional grants. Some of the reprioritization over the MTEP period include reductions in the EPWP program and 1.7 billion from the municipal infrastructure grant is shifted to the municipal disaster recovery grant. 5.6 billion reduction in the integrated national electrification program. Next slide. Next slide. Members, just to illustrate the current year spending trends in provincial government, that was already at 75.3% at the end of December 2023. Next slide. However, spending on specific Schedule 5 grants are still slow when comparing with the national benchmark of 75% as at 31 December. Just to note, the agricultural grant was only at 38.4%. In health, the health facility revitalization grant was at 48.4%, and then human settlements was at 44.8%, of which informal settlements upgrading partnership grant was only at 28.3%. Next slide. Members, just a few points on inefficiencies after observing what government is planning to do and what has been done. In terms of the rationalization of entities, government is anticipating to reduce the number of provincial and national entities by 7 from 281 to 264. Not sure by when this will be finalized. The concern is not just about rationalization, but also to standardize salary levels, specifically on executive management level. Poor conditionals, coordination between different programs within departments and between departments are observed. For example, the continuous underspending on agriculture conditional grants, specifically projects that are created to support beneficiaries of land reform. The question is how this slow spending influences the success of our land reform program. In the 2024 budget, an amount of 7.4 billion is set aside for the Presidential Employment Initiative, of which 750 million is reprioritized towards the Food Security and Livelihoods Program, which provides subsistence farmers with vouchers to purchase agricultural inputs, while the ILIMA grant with the same purpose continuously underspend. About 4 billion will be made available for hiring more teacher assistants through the Basic Education Schools Employment Initiative in provinces. This is, however, not reflected in the 2024 DORA list of allocations outside of the provincial equitable share formula, as previously done. Therefore, no evidence of this in the budget. Next slide. An amount of 1.1 billion is reprioritized towards the Social Employment Fund administered by the IDC, who has almost 40 strategic partners to promote work in local communities, which makes one think whether evidence is available that this fund is more efficient and effective than the EPWP program. 400 million has also been taken away from the Community Works program. Is this also because of inefficiencies? The city's public employment program will receive 650 million to create employment in local communities and townships to assist with the upgrading of informal settlements, developing township economies, conducting maintenance, and developing and managing public spaces and assets. The question is whether this is now a trade-off for the informal settlements upgrading partnership grant that has been reduced, or is it duplication? The National Youth Service will receive 250 million to support youth employment initiatives. The National Pathway Management Network, which is a network of networks connecting all existing networks serving unemployed young people, will receive 250 million to help connect unemployed people to job opportunities. The perception is that the maintenance of a database for job opportunities is the responsibility of the Department of Employment and Labour. In addition to the above, it is also noted that the allocation for the university subsidies, presidential youth employment intervention spending item in higher education and training has more than doubled in 2024 from 2023-24. And it is not clear whether this reprioritization is also from the original Presidential Employment Initiative funding for a different purpose. Lastly, members, we did a brief on skills development and training in an effort to get an indication of support for employment, and none of the above entities came up in our search. So the question is, how many other institutions receive funding for skills development and job creation without making a difference to our unemployment rates? Thank you. Next slide.
Good morning, Honourable Members.
I'll hand over to Bootsy.
Yes, thank you, Nelia. Good morning, Honourable Members. I'll be taking us through the real per capita analysis that the PBO has conducted. So on this slide, we see that National Treasury, The National Treasury states that the social wage will constitute an average of 60.2% of total non-interest spending over the next 3 years. This is actually lower than the 61% projected in the 2023 MTBPS. We highlight that the 2024 budget does not protect what the Treasury calls the social wage from inflation and population growth. You'll notice that we put social wage in quotation marks, and this is because we believe that the total budget or government expenditure is social wage. So if you see the categories that National Treasury considers to be the social wage, community development, employment programs, health, basic education, etc., we might have need to ask why, for example, economic development is not considered a part of the social wage. So just to highlight to members why we continuously put social wage in quotation marks. Next slide, please. In this slide, you see the real per capita spending by function group. As we've already noted previously and continuously, is that the real per capita expenditure, which means when we take into account inflation and population growth, the real per capita declines in the medium term. And just to highlight there to members that we'll be spending less in 2025-26 per person in South Africa than we spent in 2016-2017. What does this indicate? It means that we are going to be disinvesting on public expenditure. And as many members know, the majority of the population relies on the public basic services that are provided by the state. And so when we are spending less per capita terms, it means that we are eroding how much resources are actually allocated to those spheres. And as my colleagues previously noted, particularly in health sectors, we do need more expenditure. And I'll be highlighting health in the next slide. Next slide, please. In this slide, we look at real per capita spending by economic classification. Here we see a slightly different story. So what you'll notice is that the real per capita spending by economic classification actually increases, whereas the real per capita spending by function group declines per capita. So here we see that obviously the government has stated that they're focusing a lot on economic assets or rather payment of capital assets. So we do see that increase. In previous presentations, we've noted how there's an increase in that spend. However, we note here that what is happening is that there'll be a decline in the social relief of distress grants, and therefore you see declines in transfers and subsidies to households in the medium term. Next slide, please. In this slide, we focus on health specifically. National Treasury states that the health budget is anticipated to grow more slowly than inflation over the MTF due to the 23.7 billion baseline reductions over the medium term. So already there's an indication that it's growing below inflation. So when you adjust for inflation and population growth, of course, the cuts are even more severe than what it seems. In 2016-17, the government spent 3,133 per person. And in real per capita terms in 2026-27, we'll be spending less than this. We already know that the current healthcare system is overstretched, highly unequal, and severely underfunded. And as we've seen with the crisis of the hiring of doctors and so forth, given that we've learned what we should have learned, at least from COVID-19, is that we need a robust healthcare system. So disinvestment into a healthcare system over time means that we're going to be quite vulnerable should another crisis of that nature come again. Next slide, please. In this slide, we look at learner spending per learner. And then you can see that there's an increase in the medium term, which is a positive development. Previously in the MTBPS, the budgets were supposed to decrease in real per capita terms, in real per learner terms rather. So we take into account the learner population as opposed to the total population to show a better picture of how much we're spending per student in real terms. However, we note that there are going to be inflationary cuts to subsidies of schools in the medium term. We also notice that there are cuts to some programs like the HIV and AIDS grant that is provided to schools on educational basis. But also note here that the spending on early childhood development grant increases significantly, 24.5% in real terms, over the medium term, which is a positive development given that nearly 1.1 million children from age 3 to 5 do not have access to any form of early learning programs. So this is a positive development. However, the broader picture is a mixed bag, so to speak. Next slide, please. In this slide, we highlight the Social Relief of Distress Grant. As the PBO has previously highlighted, that this grant has not been adjusted for inflation, so it started off at 350 Rand and continues to be 350 Rand. However, the buying power of the SRD grant, when adjusted for inflation since 2020, means that that 350 Rand is now only valued at 286 Rand. So it has been eroded essentially by inflation over time. We've also highlighted that the allocations for the grant have been inadequate and budgets have been continued to be adjusted downward. So in that next bullet, we show how there's been 3.1 to 5.9 million people who were in the identified group who have been excluded. And as members will remember, what happened is that there was initially an allocation for 10.5 million people. However, the DSD had said that 10.9 million people would need the grant. And so Treasury only allocated 44 billion, which would only serve 10.5 billion. And therefore, DSD was forced to change the exclusion criteria or the means criteria to be able to fit into that budget. What that has meant is that continuously the number of people receiving the grant is one, not consistent because some people are being excluded every 3 months when they're reassessed, but it also means that a number of people have been excluded on the basis of the means threshold, which is significantly low to begin with. So what we highlight here as well is what we've noticed is that in the revised budget, the number that has been allocated for last year or is higher than the number that's been allocated for 2024-25. However, the number of beneficiaries is increasing. So there's an incongruence here. So the allocation is declining. However, the number of beneficiaries that are anticipated to receive the grant is increasing. So there's a question there that needs to be asked about why is it that the allocation is declining, yet the number of beneficiaries are expected to increase. And as the PBO has previously highlighted, it means that the exclusion criteria will effectively do the work of reducing the number of people who can access this grant. Next slide, please. I'll now hand over to Siraj.
Okay, thank you, Bufi. Honorable Chair, I'm going to take us through the JFICRA and the betrayal bill is basically related to providing a share of the money transferred from JFICRA to the Treasury to pay for Treasury costs. But we'll start with the background. The government's foreign exchange reserves can be thought of as a form of self-insurance against instability, financial crisis, and contagion that may harm the South African economy, particularly the financial sector and other businesses. South Africa maintains an open financial account and a floating exchange rate, which means that we are vulnerable to sudden shifts in sentiment in global financial exchange rate markets, including panic and herding behavior. So it's not only to cover the cost of certain number of months of imports, but the overall reserves is related to changes in global financial liquidity and the possibilities of those of problems in other countries, but also the problems that we will be affected by changes in global financial liquidity. The JFICRA can therefore be thought of as a service that the South African government through the Reserve Bank provides to the economy, particularly the financial services sector. JFICRA was established in terms of the South African Reserve Bank Act 90 of 1989 to manage the account on behalf of the National Treasury. Next slide, please. So Section 25 to 27 of the South Act provide for the management by the South African Reserve Bank of three accounts, the gold price adjustment account, the foreign exchange adjustment account, and the forward exchange contracts adjustment account. The Act allows the Minister of Finance and the sub-governor to settle positive balances in the JFICRA by mutual agreement. When there's a debit balance in JFICRA, it counts as a loss to the government, which is paid to the account from the National Revenue Fund. If the minister and government agree, a credit balance on JFICRA would be paid into the National Revenue Fund. The government and SARB have reached an agreement on a new framework for managing JFICRA that will require an amendment to the 2003 JFICRA Settlement Act. Next slide, please. The 2024 budget includes a proposal to withdraw 150 billion from the gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account to lower the government's borrowing requirement over the MTF. 100 billion will be allocated in the fiscal year 24-25 with an additional allocation of 25 billion earmarked for each of the subsequent fiscal years 25-26 and 26-27. Concerns have been raised that the government is drawing on unrealized gains in the chief fiscal account to reduce its debt. The National Treasury and South African Reserve Bank have explained that even after the 250 billion from GFECRA is withdrawn, that the size of South Africa's foreign exchange reserves will be large enough to ensure adequate reserves in the case of unforeseen events. There's still a debate about whether this change in transfer is going to cause it to be realized gains or not, and that that's a debate I think best left to people with lots of experience in accounts and understand the international standards. But my understanding of the Reserve Bank Act and the way in which the Reserve Bank operates, and this is other central banks as well, is that to some extent the choice of whether it's realized or not is can be discretionary. And there may be a process in the future by which the central banks, including the Reserve Bank, makes this more transparent and shows how they're following international, accounting rules and things. But I think at this point, we don't have to get into the details of that kind of debate, which I think has been come up in the public hearings and also in the media. GFECRA has operated in a way where growth into the account went unsettled. The National Treasury and SARB have agreed to a new framework for distributing the GFECRA balances into a waterfall arrangement into three pools. They've got the GFECRA buffer pool large enough to ensure that funds in the account will always be positive. The SARB's contingency reserve as a buffer to the SARB and to cover interest payments. So basically covering the costs and a buffer for the SARB. And the remaining funds then will be the last in the waterfall, the last pool, and that will be paid to the National Treasury on an annual basis. Next slide, please. So a GFECRA buffer pool has to be large enough to ensure that the funds in the account will always be positive, and currently that seems to be set at 250 billion. The SARB's contingency reserve acts as a buffer to the SARB and to cover interest rates. However, the GFECRA reform affects how foreign currency reserves are financed. For the PBO, it's a concern that the SARB has decided not to sell the forex reserves to finance the distribution to the National Treasury, but finance these funds with new South African Reserve Bank liabilities, mainly in the form of bank reserves. So the question of, will the SARB be creating more risk, or will the government with the SARB be creating more risk because our foreign exchange is declining is actually not the correct question, because the SARB has decided not to sell the the foreign exchange. They're maintaining it in the balance sheet, and they're deciding that to finance the funds to the Treasury, they're going to issue new liabilities, mainly in the form of bank reserves. So part of the GFECRA funds flowing to the second pool will be used to pay interest to the banks and the financial sector. We talked about our concern about this in the our last slide on GFECRA, and I'll come back to that. The reserves deposited at the SARB by the banks are going to be remunerated at the policy rate, basically at the repo rate. If remaining funds will be paid to the National Treasury on an annual basis, while the initial payments will be 150 billion over the next 3 years, subsequent payments into this final pool will very likely be zero over a number of years or much lower, because it took about 2 decades to build up the 500 billion reserve. I mean, this is going to be dependent on what happens to the rand relative to other currencies. I don't think we can expect to see anywhere near the levels that we are flowing into the National Treasury after the 3 years from that last pool. The GFECRA buffer pool is... Sorry, can you go to the next slide, please? So some concerns with the GFECRA arrangement. By holding large levels of foreign exchange, the government provides a free service to the entire economy, for which the banks and financial sector gain disproportionately huge benefits. So I spoke in the first slide in the background, basically this is a form of self-insurance for the country that provides benefits to the country, but particularly to the financial sector, and it's an unpaid for service that the financial sector gets by the government holding these reserves. So the PBO is concerned that the SARB has chosen to pay for the transfer to the National Treasury by increasing reserves of banks and financial institutions that will be remunerated at the high policy interest rate. The PBO views the use of GFECRA as a positive step, as it illustrates the government's ability to utilize its entire public sector balance sheet to generate fiscal space. However, the National Treasury and SARB's use of GFECRA does not indicate a move to consider the broader balance sheet to deal with the current unemployment, poverty, and inequality crisis, and is negative on development and growth prospects. The current framework actually will create more constraints on the government accessing GFECRA to deal with other emergencies in the future. The new arrangement makes it harder. The PBO is also concerned with the use of the funds. We think it should not only be earmarked for debt reduction. Instead, it should be strategically allocated to finance a targeted fiscal stimulus for the economy, to reduce suffering related to high levels of poverty, and to support a developmental approach that will increase growth and future revenue. I will pass on to my next colleague. Thank you. Sitambiso.
Thank you so much. Chairperson, honorable members, good morning to you all, and thank you for the opportunity to address the committee this morning. My name is Thembiso Mthimkhulu. I'd like to give you a brief breakdown of the second adjustment appropriation bill. The second adjustment appropriation bill includes the reallocation of 470 million. Essentially, the total additions of 470 million with a similar size reduction. Now, the allocation of the Department of Cooperative Government has been adjusted downward by 400 million due to a contract not being finalized on the time with a new implementing agent for the Community West Program. On the Home Affairs, the Department of Home Affairs has received 200 million to increase the political party funding. Next slide, please. Now, the Department of International Relations and Cooperation has been allocated an additional of 80 million for hosting of the BRICS summit in 2023-2024 financial year. The public works and infrastructure allocation have been adjusted downward by 70 million due to underspending. The funding will be shifted to the presidency for the Ministry of Electricity and e-cabinet system. Next slide. 95 million has been allocated to cover 2023-2024 public service wage agreement increases for justice and constitutional development, and the Office of the Chief Justice for Court Service, the NPA, and the Judicial Education and Support. Thank you. I'm now handing over to Dr. Yankis for conclusion.
Thank you so much, colleagues, and thank you once more, Chair members. I think we're trying to emphasize that the Division of Revenue equitably shares the amount raised nationally in those proportions. And there is a very aim by government to allocate proportion to transfers to local government over the current year, over the MTF. I think just to emphasize the message about our projections that shows that the growth outlook over the medium term is significantly below what we require to be inadequate to some of the unemployment and inequality, poverty, and some of the socio-economic situation that we're sitting with. But also, our projection does underscore our projection for how will be unemployment, poverty, and inequality be over the medium term underscores the inadequacy of appropriations for social support of vulnerable society and the likelihood of the government realizing these targets over the remaining years of the NDP. The utilization of funds are being implemented primarily for equitable shares, conditional and conditional grants in the community and economic development functions within this, which focus a lot on these groups for composition of employees. Over the MTF, the government stated the priority is to really enhance quality of spending and deal with inefficiencies while at the same time stabilizing public finances. Next slide. Despite the priorities to minimize efficiency, some of the positions of the funding shows little evidence that the enhancing of the quality in particular areas that are concerning us. Given the changes of functions of government or the MTF and the decline in real per capita, the previous concern about the government's performance in realizing this. So we are saying already we can see now that we are unlikely to reach some of these targets at this stage, and we are concerned that the most we don't to come to realize those. Some of the issues, several initiatives the government delivers capacity to ensure effectiveness of service delivery and identify some of these challenges by the government as well, which we want to also reemphasize the importance of addressing these, in particular inefficiencies, ineffectiveness and productiveness, the issue of leadership, stability in some of the government entities, the issue of follow through on the cabinet positions being implemented, the pace in the correct number of entities, and some of these weakness in public procurement. Some of the challenges that actually make it difficult for government to have some of the targets they set out themselves. Next slide. The question then remains, Chair and members, if the fiscal policy and allocation of funds through the appropriations and division of revenue do not result in outcome in the search by the NDP, what then has to be done in particular in making sure that we realize? It's a question that, in our view, oversight has to respond to and in guiding government realizing those objectives. The use of GFECRA is a positive step from our perspective that illustrates the government's ability to draw an entire budget, public sector budget, to really deal with fiscal space. The 150 billion GFECRA injection should not solely be used for debt, in our view, but should also be used to strategically allocate funds to get some of the important government objectives in particular. The EU is concerned that the banks and financial institutions will be limited to the high policy initiative in that regard because of the way the system works in particular. We'll just stop there, Chair, and thank you so much and with members for the opportunity. We save a bit of time. Thank you so much for the opportunity. We'll wait for the questions. Thanks, colleagues. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much, Dr. Janchis and the team for the presentation. Dr. Siraj, Dr. Nelia, Kahiso, Lwazikazi, Busi, and Stembiso. I think those were all our presenters. Thank you very much, colleagues. All members, here are the presentations on the three bills that we are dealing with at the moment. You know how we do it. Can I have indications of all members who'd like to have a go on the presentations?
Tobias. Mlenzana, please.
Honorable Tobias. Honorable Mlenzana. Honorable members. And Honorable Normal Tafa, oh, you managed to join Normal Tafa. You're complaining about your connectivity. Any other honorable member? Honorable members? Honorable members? I've got honorable Tobias. Come again?
It's Humphrey, but I think I'm likely to be covered.
Don't define yourself out. Any other oral member?
Kaiso.
Honorable Kaiso.
Kaiso.
Yes, Honorable Kaiso, I noted you. Okay. Thank you very much. Let me see if there's anybody. Okay. That's fine. You may take down your hands, honorable members. I've noted you. Honorable Tobias, you're the first one. Please go. You know, honorable members, I don't want to limit your time, but again, be cognizant of the fact that there are other members who would like to speak after you've spoken. You go, honorable Tobias.
Thanks, Chair. I'll try my best not to be long-winded. First, let me appreciate the presentation. Chair, in the history of knowing PBO, especially Dr. Siraj, this is the first time I don't hear him making a comment or on a policy issue. I wonder why this time, but let me go to the point. The slide that attracted my attention, Dr. Janchis, is the conclusion that you made. The first point, and I want, Chair, if I can, I request him to get back to the slides, please, the last slide on the conclusion. Or is it the next slide? There's a first point I want to refer to. Chair, I will not take your time, please. I just want to refer to that slide on conclusion.
Take your time, Honorable Tobias. Don't be intimidated by the chair.
Yeah, on conclusion, not on the GPEC. No, you passed, I think it's the first slide on the conclusion. Yes, point number one. No, that's not the point I wanted to refer to. How many slides on conclusion do you have? There's the one asking a question. Yeah, here it is.
I think the next one. There's the second one.
There's a point that's asking a question on conclusion. After
this
speaking,
this is the one.
The question then remains if fiscal policy and the allocation of funds to the appropriations and division of revenue bills do not result in the outcomes envisaged by the NDP, what else needs to be done? Chair, I want to make a suggestion that this question, we develop a session, if it's acceptable, to debate the shortcomings of the NDP towards achieving our 2030 goals so that we can address the last part of the question, what else needs to be done so that we are able to formulate suggestions, if it's acceptable. That's the first point. Second, I must put a rider. I do not doubt the confidence of the central bank with its duties, fiduciary responsibilities in managing South African investments and the monetary and the fiscal policy. There's no doubt about that. And the question doesn't even relate to whether GFECRA is going to address the debt service cost. It's not that. The issue what this slide did not do today is to apportion what else will National Treasury use the money addressed by GFECRA on. And one of those issues, if I listened carefully last week, was paying the wage bill. And this is what I would want us to discuss. Whether is this the best modalities put in place to tap on our investments to come and address the wage bill. I'm not concerned about the debt service cost. We should service our debts. That's the part I'm worried about. And second to that, there comes a point where when we say there's been issues, and that's where I want to take you to that slide where you talk about inefficiencies of SOEs, Dr. Janji's, and the role of leadership in terms of cabinet and so on. If we can go, because those slides speak a mouthful of what needs to be done going forward so that we don't just throw these issues. Now, is it possible to go back to that slide, Dr. Janji?
Last one.
It was the one that speaks about leadership, SOEs, and so on, in making a diagnosis about the challenges of achieving the NDP goals. Yes, you see these issues that are related here. Yeah, I think it's about 2, 4, 6, 7 points. At some point, we need to engage ourselves on these points and be able to address those challenges raised by these points. If we're saying we're having an ineffective and unproductive state, what else do we do to address that? And these are the issues that I think we can make recommendations on. Slow implementation of cabinet decisions. How then do we push for the faster implementation of decisions, dealing with weaknesses in the state procurement systems and so on. But above all, this, how do we have a stimulus package, which is something that needs all stakeholders, Chair, Parliament, the private sector, the public sector, to come together and discuss the stimulus package and its role in injecting into economic growth. And we can't run away from that and just give an analysis that shows the projections and not speaking to how then do we go forward. I don't know, Chair, I was long-winded. Let me stop there for now. Thank you.
Honorable Tobias, no, you are not. You're still having a few minutes in my own time. Do you still have something you want to add?
Chair, I'll come back later when there's been response, because possibly they will intrigue a further engagement. But I'm not happy with Dr. Siraj. He's a very good policy analyst so far, and today it's like he's avoiding to say anything. So I want to still hear his voice. Thanks.
Okay. Honorable Mlenzana, please come in.
Greetings, Chairperson. I will try. I have got about 5 questions. Can you hear me? Chairperson?
Very well, thank you. Please continue.
Okay.
Yes.
No, thanks, thanks, thanks. Let me start by appreciating this presentation. Let me switch off this video, Chair, if you allow me. Thanks. Let me start by appreciating this presentation. It's a presentation, Chair, following a series of other presentations which have been made around the same topical issues. So, Dr. Chanches, we continue to appreciate your presentations because you are sharpening our thinking going towards decision-making on the 3 pieces of legislation. Chairperson, I have deliberately drafted this, some of these questions to be overarching. One on equitable share allocation, both to provinces and to municipalities, that is local government. I just want to check your wisdom here, Dr. Chanches and team. The tool that is currently being used, is it relevant? Is it talking to the needs? Is it talking to the current, for instance, climatic conditions? Does it in any way begin to talk to the calamities that the country has faced? Your COVID-19, for instance, your KZN issue of July 2021, your disasters across in many ways. Are those considered, or it is just a numbers game where the desktop exercise, punching numbers, after which then automatically the computer would give answers? That's my first question, Chair. The second one is, you know, Chairperson, I would always be worried around the management of non-expenditure or sticking to the cash flow as per the projections, as informed by the original budget. I'm using the word original, team TPO deliberately, because I would be coming to the adjustment bill. Now, I'm saying, I've been asking this question, I would like to get your view. There is the district development model, Chairperson. And I personally have trust in the DTM. However, I feel that DTM doesn't have beef to bite. I feel that whether it's through legislation, Dr. Chanches and Tim, or however, the DTM, according to my thinking, is supposed to synergize, coordinate, and further be responsible for financial management, both horizontally, that is across departments and entities, and also vertically, that is flowing from national down to local level, if possible. If you can have a bite on that. Also, Chair, I'm thinking of the infrastructure development generally. These programs, how can you evaluate the performance Team PBO on the performance of government in terms of exploiting infrastructure development programs to influence employment and economic growth, particularly at a domestic level. I don't want to delve into what was raised by Honorable Topias in her first, you know, questioning or inputs when she was talking of the financial stability and all. The other one, this one, Chair, it's more generic. The second last, if you can bear with me. It's more generic. What is the overall thrust of the three pieces of legislation as put here today to the State of the Nation Address? Do you see any realization of SONA through these pieces of legislation? Do these pieces of legislation have got anything to do in terms of realization of the implementation of the injunctions as tabulated in SONA? And then the very last chair, as I've said, would be going back somehow linking with my second question on the reprioritization of budget through the second adjustment bill. Now, can you evaluate us in terms of the overall non-expenditure or the overall over-expenditure or general performance by departments and entities? Have we in the 5 years stuck to the budget, or we have been found wanting? If we have been found wanting, where? On the side of non-expenditure, side of over-expenditure, side of sticking to the budget as was originally adopted. I'm raising this chair, you know. I am very passionate and willing to see a situation where down the line there would be realization of zero-based budgeting. But you cannot talk zero-based budgeting if we are unable to stick to these baselines as projected in terms of the original budget. Thanks, Chair, and bear me for the time, please.
Thank you so much, Honorable Mlengana. No problem. Oral Metapha, please come in. Metapha, are you there, or you are disconnected? You are struggling with this connectivity. Okay. While waiting for Oral Metapha to come in, let me go to Honorable Memezi.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, let me start by indeed appreciating the presenters. I think they are showing a good team planning how to give each other opportunity. Also, Chair, one want to appreciate the how brutal the presentation is on the whole performance of government. I think I really get encouraged when... Yes, sir. I think the point that we really appreciate to the leadership of the team treasury, at least we must know where we are. We must know what are the issues. So then finding a solution from where I sit is then possible, because you know where are the problems. I think the other members have already gone to then want to understand. I think from Honorable Tobias wanting the particular senior official to really be the way he usually is in terms of calling a spade a spade. And then also what Honorable is already saying, I think is already indicating, Team Treasury, you are showing that you can see, but maybe you are stopping short of giving the solutions. So one point, Chair, from where I sit, generally, government, we lacking consequence management, and we don't implement, there's no penalty. You do good, we clap for you. You do bad, you do nothing, we just keep quiet. So we don't do, there are no steps, there are no penalties. I think National Treasury must come with something, suggest something. And of course, it's not like a duty of National Treasury, but it's one of the department that can assist, because it's clear money is there, but we're not spending properly. I think that's where I would want it to be assisted. If consequence management can't, and the penalties, can't that assist whole of government? Because we have clear targets, you don't achieve targets, then you must face the music. And then in that way, everybody would know that in government in South Africa, we're not playing. So I think, Chair, I don't have much. Thank you.
Thank you, Memezi. Oron Matafa, please come in.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, team PBO. My apologies, Chair, for earlier. As I indicated, I'm having a bit of a challenge with my network. As such, I'm going to request to keep my video off just to be safe.
Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, let me start by welcoming the presentation and thanking the presenters who came in and are well coordinated. Chair, let me first start by agreeing with most of the points in the conclusion as raised by Dr. Janchis. But also in no way to try to respond to Honorable Tobias, because I wanted to agree, especially on the part where there is a point that is raised about the alignment and linkage or the outcomes of the Division of Revenue Bill vis-a-vis the NDP goals. But secondly, that the PBO rises on the point that the GFECRA should not only be used for that purposes. And that's why I'm saying I'm not trying to respond to Honorable Tobias. I think that she wants specifics. But the PBO then says that it's important that it also should be used for strategic allocation to finance a targeted fiscal stimulus. So I want to concur and agree with that one. Having ended on that point, I think one which is also connected to this one, and Honorable Mlenzana spoke on the SONA injunctions, if whether is an observation that this budget is responding to the SONA. I want to extend it to ask about its alignment to the Economic Recovery and Reconstruction Plan, as alluded by the President to be the pointer in terms of turning the economy around. Do we observe a linkage between the budget as well as the ERRP, and also taking into account the points that Honorable Zembo Mlenzana has raised? So just on a general point, most commentators are currently proposing an introduction of the wealth tax in order to augment the revenue collection capabilities by the state. Can PBO just express a view on this matter? The second one, Chair, is on slide 3, where the PBO mentions that the 350 grant, it is not yet in line with the poverty line of 760. Now, I just want to request a view from the PBO on the two raging discussions. One, There is proposal that the SRD grant must be increased. Could we then be saying, should we increase it to this level? Two, there is also a discussion around the basic income grant. What is the view of the PBO on these two discussions that are raging? And if whether is it feasible, given the current fiscal position we are in, to be considering the basic income grant? And if then it's agreed upon, can we then argue that 760 should be the minimum? Chair, slide 22 speaks of the decline of the number of households receiving free basic services in 2018. I might appear to be a bit political, but I just wanted to find out if whether can we correctly say this is related to the emergence of coalition government. I'm saying this, Chair, because in 2016, we saw power exchange hands, most big metros being led by the opposition in terms of the national political party standing. And these coalitions formed a local government, in some instances, intervened in a strong-handed manner. I'll give an example of the city of Tshwane, where I come from. The DA-led administration cancelled the indigenous program that was in place before 2016, removed all beneficiaries from receiving free basic services, and encouraged them to re-register so that they are able to say that indeed this particular old person, the poor of the poor, does qualify to be on this platform. But the PBO correctly states that the registration process is erroneous, is too cumbersome, is too frustrating for the ordinary person or the ordinary resident on the street. Can we link it to coalition governments? And if yes, what can be done to avoid this unfortunate situation? Because the PBO also states, and correctly so, that in some instances, even in the appropriations, there's inadequacy to give proper support to the most vulnerable of our society. But where you have a situation that basic services or indigenous programs are not accessible, what is to be done? Because in that case, it will mean that we are actually pushing deeper the poverty stricken into the cycle of poverty. Those are my points, Chairperson. Let me appreciate you for your patience as far as my network is concerned and your indulgence to allow me to participate in this discussion. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you so much, Honorable Matafa. Honorable Kaiso, please come in.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I would also like to appreciate the presentation made by the Office of the Budget Office and the contributions which my colleagues have already attributed to. And agree on a number of areas which they've raised around the division of revenue and other two bills. So, Chair, I just want to hit just on the point where Honorable Tandi was raising, and I agree with that. Perhaps it is really necessary to bring about a discussion or a debate around that particular issue which the fiscal framework plays, you know. Remember this, the population of the country has increased way beyond now 60, and we still using whatever that we are using in as far as the fiscal framework is concerned. So we keep on referring to unemployment and inequalities, so which have been following us over the past three decades. So it means there is something that we need to do really differently as far as what fiscal framework is actually intended to address in as far as that is growing, especially around the National Development Plan. So I want to agree with that. And also look or club together with, you know, a discussion on the role of the Reserve Bank. I think Treasury has to do more when it comes to that. There has to be a serious look at as to how does the role that is being played by the Reserve Bank around the job creation or unemployment, which part that it can play itself, you know, but it won't just be automatic, but it's obviously, it says, review the policy mandate of the Reserve Bank in such a way that at least it does reflect on the two areas, not only on how the inflation impacts upon the growth of the economy. So there has to be a serious look or discussion around that, perhaps in the form of a discussion in the future, Honorable Chair. And I do understand that the PBO has given us a breakdown in as far as division of revenue, you know, allocation on equitable share and provincial, you know, some shift in provincial allocation there. But then the issue of spending is very critical because we are not only just interested in just general information that is this province has been allocated this much in terms of, you know, equitable share. But sometimes this general information hits some important areas there, such as the expenditure. The spending part of it, that's where one is interested. To say, much as we see there is a nice spread in, and increase in the provincial equitable share, etc., but can you also give us a breakdown as to, as we then this breakdown has been given, can you also focus on the spending part of it? You know, because there are a number of, you know, that one would cover under grants, especially on the spending part of it, because that's where we're worried. So, yeah. So I just want to raise that those areas first, and also agree on the areas of recovery plan, as Honorable Nelson has also talked about, and then Honorable Oscar. Can I also come into this area, because we are talking about economic growth, unemployment, and poverty. But at the same time, the PBO raises a critical look at the agricultural conditional grants, you know, of 7.4 billion, okay. But then there's an ILIMA grant. And when you see 750 million of ILIMA grant assigned to, you know, that department, but it is this pure utilization, or it's not been, it is being underspent. It's a serious problem when you read that statement with the statement, which says unemployment, inequality, and poverty. And then you put the other statement on the other side, 750 million ILIMA grant unspent. Or underspend, sorry, on food, food and on food and poverty. So it creates a very serious problem, that statement. And this has been recurrent, that there are these grants in the agricultural department which are not sufficiently being utilized. So perhaps if you can give a breakdown, where or which areas are you in particularly concerned as another information? Well, 750 is perhaps it's not only in one province, but it might be one province, I don't know, but it doesn't have any breakdown. But we just see 750 million ILIMA grant. So there might be particular people who really do not make any use of this grant, whereas we are facing unemployment, inequality, and poverty. So it's one request. On the social development SRD grant, I think it is proper that that department review its, review the number of beneficiaries such that now it is able to be inclusive and consistent with its allocation. I'm reading what the slide presented by PBO has said, because it says they picked up inconsistency in terms of what has been allocated and the number of beneficiaries. So then that department has to review that in such a way that it's now consistent with what is being allocated. On the last, and appreciate the role, one would like to appreciate one song, the GFREC bill, which has been decided upon and announced. It's a positive step moving forward. I think I also want to agree with my colleague that perhaps in future there has to be a framework in which the GFECRA will be utilized proficiently, such that it guides its utilization moving forward in future. So I'm referring to areas such as, which can stimulate the economy, not only looking at the debt, and salaries, but also the area which can enhance growth, so that it is now sustainable. Because if we just take money and then we not replace, it will create a problem moving forward. So it won't show any growth of whatsoever. So it means that we may reach again a mark time when it comes to debt, whereas we have managed to utilize 150 billion. But at some stage, because we not utilize GFECRA for good purpose, identify, target areas where stimulation can happen, such that now there is at least a growth, we may reach a mark time. So look at the areas of the economic sectors, or invest in the infrastructure investment, utilizing this fund, for instance, it can at least do us something rather than only taking it the portion and then only look at the settling debt. But at least if we also invest in the infrastructure, the GFECRA, remains sustainable for a quite long period. So it's one area that one would like to make submission on, Honorable Chair. And then I think the rest I'm covered is what my colleagues have raised. Thank you very much, Chair.
Honorable Taiso, thank you very much. Before I come in, then honorable member who has not spoken would like to come in before we proceed.
Chair, I have spoken, but I wanted to clarify something. I was misconstrued at some point.
Okay, why don't you leave the people must answer the questions, Honorable Tobias, then.
Okay.
Whether they also misunderstood you. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you so much, Dr. Janchis and the team for the presentation. Let me deal with my questions. We budget for free basic services. I just want to check with you. Do we understand why only 3.2 million out of 10 million households receive them? the biggest reduction was in public works, if I remember well. What does it say about our commitment to spending on infrastructure as a way of accelerating inclusive economic growth? Perhaps let me, if you were in the shoes of National Treasury, how would you have dealt with this one, taking into account the reasons which they advance of doing of that budget cut? On slide 8, I think Dr. Neda was dealt with slide 8. I would like you to go back to this slide and go over it. You spoke about changes in percentages of local government equitable share. Please, let's say, if you could just take us through that. There's something I missed. One of the things which have been raised in this forum and other fora is a risk of duplicating some of our interventions, especially if you look at the expanded public works programs and so forth. And then there's always this, that there is a risk of duplication. How would we deal with this one? Because I think I agree with that you may find that there's a lot of duplication in these things and stretching the resources which you don't have and as having ultimately a very big impact with what we try to do. We try to do everything, and you have got all these interventions, especially around for public works and so on. What should be done about this? I think let's be a solution orientated. Talking about grants, I just want to check how big is the problem of WDP when it comes to these many grants. Perhaps a challenge which I'll give you a PBO, something that the project that you may want to work on, is to do a thorough research on all these grants and perhaps come with your proposal from your side that that's how we can get maximum output or maximum impact out of these grants. Because it, as a matter of fact, there are so many of these grants and you end up not seeing the optimal impact. Dr. Siraj and dear Dr. Sanchez, when it comes to GFEC, one thing you speak about, it's the question that let it not only be used for debt reduction, let it be used for other broader socio-economic imperatives of the country. Perhaps there's something I'm missing. I'm saying, does it matter? Because all what it means is that the money that was going to be used for debt reduction now can be used for these other things. Tell me if there's a blind spot that I'm having. I think one area that we've tried as a committee, even when we interact with the departments, to try and stress is that with a budget now of about 2.3 trillion rand, how do we use that to try and stimulate growth? How do we use that budget to try and localize? How do we use that budget to try and create employment opportunities, especially for the young people. We had an opportunity, and I'm not sure whether Dr. Chanchis, you were there, as a committee to do an oversight. One of the oversights that we undertook was to go to a Kibela train manufacturing plant in Ekurhuleni, Denaton. And we were saying, and that's where you saw government using its buying power to stimulate a certain industry. State-of-the-art trains are being manufactured, not assembled, are being manufactured in Ekurhuleni by the Kibela Consortium, which used government, BRAFA used government budget to create that facility which is there. It was just farms all over. Perhaps, Honorable Lenzana, again, it was a demonstration of what can happen with DDM, because there was involvement an entity, BRAFA. There was an involvement of Department of Transport. There was involvement of local government, Ekurhuleni. Minister Mojo Kungubele was still a mayor there, and they helped about identifying the land and so on and so forth. I would like to say to you, Dr. Chanchis and your team, I would like you to put all that to that facility so that you can understand what can be done with a budget that is allocated to. And we don't use budget to import things. The easiest way out would have been to import trains. But that option was not taken. And all of you know here what we say about the importing things, that it's one, it's negative on your GDP, as you know, but two, it's negative on your revenue. Three, you are exporting your jobs opportunities to other countries. So saying with this big budget, what can we do to try and stimulate that? At the end of the day, you've got private sector coming and so on doing these things. You don't do things that you don't have capacity, but as to where those things happen, it's very important. So I'm saying to you, Dr. Chanchis, one of the things that perhaps you must carry forward in your interacting with our committees, especially the appropriations, is the question of using the budget to try and help with these things that we are trying to do as a country. Lastly, but not least, what do they say? Least but not last. Yeah, I think that's the correct English. Given the little or no mention of economic recovery plan, is it safe to say that NT has moved beyond this policy? According to the PBO, is the economy still in a recovery mode, or it is the right time to focus on policy directions beyond economic recovery? Next one. One of the major pronouncements that National Treasury made in past budget is the zero-based budgeting that has been spoken about, and this was said to cap inefficiencies and wastage. When evaluating the 2024 budget-related bills, does the PPO find signs of zero-based budgeting? And perhaps even related to that, I know there's a lot about zero budgeting. Do you believe that this is a panacea to the problems that we are facing around inefficiencies and under expenditures that are in the department? So with those questions, let me allow you, Dr. Chanchis, and your team, you know who you answer what questions, and please bring the meeting back to me once all the questions have been attended to. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, members. Thank you once more. These are very good questions. Some of them are very difficult to answer, but we'll try and answer some of them. But very, very good questions indeed. I'll let the team speak to the questions and I'll come in. But I just want to very quickly comment on what I would call policy questions. Just a quick comment, and I give the team to, and I'll come back later. I think the question on wealth tax, we haven't done work on that, but I think what we've said before is that government had promised to go and look at the stats to say the level of wealth and how much wealth is there in the economy and how can it be taxed. My proposal would be to say the committee invite SARS to come and provide status on that progress, because my sense is that there was a lot of consensus around the discussion that there is a space for wealth tax to impose some of those wealthy individuals and assets in particular, or, you know, so I would say rather invite SARS and initiatives to come and give status on how much individuals have wealth and what's the level of wealth in order to thinking around the imposing tax on that. The question of the basic grant, again, we haven't done work. We're still doing the work with a project that's been running for a while. But when you look at a lot of work that's been done right around the area, and one of the strong evidence that comes out from a lot of work is that having some form of, but also learning from the grants that we have, in particular, when you look at, we've had a lot of grants, a very important safety net over the years, you've seen that when you're supporting low-income households, you are, in a way, injecting, investing in society, investing in the economy. You are more likely to have more employment created, more likely to support households, but also you are more likely to have less inequality. As you've seen with the intervention of 350 grants, it does support most vulnerable, and having that large scale would be part of the economic development strategy, because, you know, sectors will grow, but also even government revenue are likely to increase, and economic growth will also grow. But again, like I say, we'll look at that more in detail in that regard. The issue of coalition governments and service levels is a very important point. We haven't done work again on that, but I think what we've seen over the local government sector is a potential to impact if there are a lot of discussion, or it takes longer to approve the budget, or you have a lot of change. So what we'll say, it's very important to have a very clear framework that guides, which protects the ability of the government to deliver services within that context. It's a very complex issue, a very lot of nuances. But I think what we would say is that there has to be a clear framework that guides how this gets implemented, or when you have coalition local governments, how you manage them, or whichever level it can be. ERRP, what you've seen, Chair and members, what we have seen over the years when we had a lot of discussion on ERRP, Economic Health Construction Plan, we did show that there wasn't much of new policy initiatives around that. When you look at some of the ERRP targets and policy proposed priorities, were largely coming from the MTSF, from NDP, so just repackaging of it. Hence, in my view, I wouldn't say it's been done away, but you find that probably it was based a lot on some of the measures that's already set out in the MTSF. The issues, the progress has been done in a broader sense of the MTSF of the current term. So I allow colleagues, but I think what I wanted to message to emphasize, there was major new proposals in the ARP, or just replicating some of the issues that are already in the NDP, MTSF, but also within the State of Nation Address that came in there. There was a lot of repackaging to prioritize specifics over others there. I'll leave it there and then I'll come in later. But the last point I wanted to comment on is around the wage bill. Let me leave the colleagues to come in. I'll come in later with some of the points that I noted here. Colleagues, you want to come in? Nelia, do you want to start? And then Siraj, and then colleagues who want to pick up some of the points there. Thank you so much, Chen.
Thank you, Dr. Janke. I'll try, but it might be that I won't cover everything that I actually want to talk about. Honorable Tobias, in terms of the conclusion, what else needs to be done? I'm very much passionate about performance information. And at this stage, our performance information is not good enough for us really to evaluate or even to monitor the spending on what departments is supposed to do in terms of the goals set for the NDP. So I've got a lot of examples. Just to give you an example, in terms of the responsible lead departments in terms of the unemployment, for example, outcome for the current MTSF. The departments are Department of Employment and Labour, DPME, and then Public Works. Those are the three main departments responsible for job creation. And all of those departments have got targets that they've got to report on. But if you really go into the detail in terms of the reporting on the jobs that have been created, you actually find that that department actually didn't really create the job. They actually just maintained a database, for example. So did they really create jobs? So in terms of the thinking and the debate that we have to have are those departments really the main departments that that are responsible for creating jobs? So there's a lot of issues in terms of the lead departments, the indicators that have been set that needs to, and the actions that need to be taken in terms of the creation of jobs. And in one of my slides, I also indicated in terms of, we try to identify in one of our briefs, all the departments and entities that are responsible for skills development for job creation. And I think it might only be the half that we actually identified in the estimates of national expenditure, because all of a sudden now in this budget, there's a lot of others that came up, especially the transfer to the IDC. I never thought that the IDC would have gotten funding or a transfer for job creation. In terms of, yes, and that list that we've listed in the conclusion was actually the DPME actually presented that list to this committee in terms of their findings, what is wrong, in terms of under that list, that challenges are actually all in terms of building a capable ethical and developmental state. And so how does those findings and challenges actually gets fed into the budget decisions? There is a process, and DPME is also part of the discussions when budgets are allocated, but we don't know how it filters through at the end of the day. In terms of Honourable Mlenzana, the performance of government on infrastructure programs, yeah, we basically just there's a annexure to the budget review in terms of progress made with big infrastructure projects. It can be monitored, but we don't see the expenditure in terms of the budget. Honourable. Trust of the budget in terms of linking it to SORNA. Members, in our budget presentation, we did like a comparison since 2019, what were SORNA priorities. And two of the things that really came up over the five-year period was really to focus on job creation. And the other one that also came up, one of the priorities over the five-year period, was to fight corruption. And we can see the budget did respond to it, but was it really, did we really get results in terms of the expenditure? In terms of the zero-based budgeting, I think last year the Treasury indicated that they're not going to go into zero-based budgeting. They're not going to implement it. It's not going to be viable, and departments don't have the capacity to implement zero-based budgeting. In terms of the conclusion of DORA versus the NDP, I think I've answered that, might have answered that. There was also a question in terms of the conditional grants. Actually, for a few years now, the PBO did an analysis on all the conditions, basically all the conditional grants in terms of their performance. And how that performed in terms of their spending. All those documents have been circulated to members, but we can also circulate them again, and where we actually did the comparison in terms of the performance, did you perform? And we also identified some of the shortcomings in the conditional grants in terms of the indicators that they set. In most of the conditional grants, they don't set targets. And there's also a whole range of other issues that we've identified in terms of the challenges with conditional grants. Honorable Butlezi, the Public Works Department, the reductions, it was mainly for EPWP, the Property Management Trading Institution entity, and then they indicated that they also reduced a lot of funding to various non-state sector programs. It's just one amount, not individual amounts. How will we deal with duplication? We really need to rethink, and I'm sure the Treasury's reviews that they do also identify all those duplications. But what does it mean if you identify a lot of duplications in the different programs or in conditional grants? It means either you stop that program or you stop that grant and you allocate all the funding to a program that is more efficient and effective. Or, I don't know, you build capacity in that program to ensure that they perform. ERRP, I'm not going to say much about the ERRP, but members, the ERRP identified a lot of big capital projects, and the Treasury actually do monitor, and they are still very much involved with those projects in terms of their operation, Wool and Lela. And last year, they also published a document with the performance or the progress on the performance of all those projects. Thank you. That's what I'm going to respond to. Thank you.
Siraj, you are coming. Thanks, Nelia.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and Dumsani. Thank you for calling me next. I want to start off with the question of GFECTRA, because that was sort of my main contribution to this presentation. And the question that Honorable Butlezi asked was, you know, does it make a difference whether you pay off your debt or whether you doing what we're saying, use part of it for a fiscal stimulus? And if we look at the fiscal framework and the way in which the budget has been set out, this $150 billion is not being spent into the economy. It's used to reduce the amount of debt that government needs to take on. And that will, you know, reduce the government's debt stock, and it also will, you know, reduce the debt repayments in the future. But what it won't do is play a role in, you know, helping people be less poor, won't have any multipliers through the economy, which are spent into the economy. It won't contribute to the kind of project that Honorable Butlezi spoke about in terms of, you know, the domestic building of trains, for instance. So that money is sort of being kept out of the economy, even though it does reduce the overall debt level. Particularly within the next few years, when that money is drawn out of GFECTRA. But it also then brings us, I think, to the bigger question, and I think the broader policy type issue is, you know, how do we think about what is going to drive growth? And again, I think the example used by Honorable Butlezi, when he asked about the question, you know, how to get the budget to promote growth. And I think, you know, talking about that kind of project, which is not only about local procurement, but it's much more. It's about building the dynamism of the manufacturing base in the economy and being able to produce those kinds of, you know, things needed that provide, you know, part linked to the infrastructure development, linked to providing services, transport services, and you know, deepen the development base of the economy. And this is, I think, one of the key differences that has come up in our debates between myself and PBO and the National Treasury, is that they've been questioning the fiscal multiplier and using that as a main argument to say that government spending into the economy doesn't actually create that much growth. And we've been arguing that, you know, it depends on which studies you look at and the approach being used. So, but also saying that the notion of growth itself, focusing only on growth, is inadequate. You know, growth is an important aspect and we want the economy to grow. But in terms of thinking through the what makes up growth, what makes up GDP from a demand side, from the expenditure side, you know, it's government spending, it's household consumption, and people call it consumption, government consumption and household consumption, but a huge part of that money is actually investment into the economy, households investment into providing for the reproduction of a productive population that can contribute to economic activity, that, you know, to nurture and develop the talents of a, particularly a fairly young population to be able to go out and make an important contribution. And then the other aspect of it is investment and the kind of investments that Honorable Buthelezi was talking about, which are very much then, I think, can be linked back to both the government's consumption and household consumption, as partly also investments in communities and also, you know, in resilience of households and the ability of households to reproduce. And so another critique that we have of this approach, you know, that the fiscal multiplier is low and it's not going to cause GDP to increase, is to say, well, if you're not counting the household work, mostly done by women, that's not counted in GDP, unpaid labor, but that makes a huge contribution to the economy, then your measures for the fiscal multiplier are also leaving out a big part of the story. And so in thinking through the budget growth, more than growth, development, and development that can contribute towards changing the growth part of this economy, transforming the structure, not only, you know, reform and reconstruction, ERRP type projects, but also looking towards a long-term vision, that is important. And so just to make a quick comment about ERRP, I know my director and Ilya mentioned it, but I think part of the problem with you know, setting long-term vision and goals like ERRP is that it becomes subsidiary to the concern with the expenditure ceilings, the need to run surpluses and pay off debts, rather than seeing it as part of a recovery process that will lead to hopefully future growth that will then cause the debt to GDP level to decline, but also in terms of the kind of broader waves that kind of recovery will have within the economy and support the developmental part. On the wealth tax, I just wanted to say, you know, that for me, I know Dr. Jansi said we need to sort of bring out more research and work and speak to SARS and things, but in terms of looking at the wealth distribution in South Africa, which we put up, I think, you know, a few times over the past few years, we put up especially the numbers from the World Inequality Lab on South Africa. You know, we show that the top 1%, this is not the top 10%, the top 1%, right, have a huge share of the wealth of the country. You're looking at 52%. But within that, you know, 0.01% of the population, which they estimate maybe, you know, under 4,000 people, have 15% of the wealth. And then if you add to that the next 0.09, so you look at the top 0.1%, it's another 14.9. So the top 0.1% totally have about 30% of the wealth. And then you look at the top 1%, then you add that to it, it goes to 52%. And then the top 10% adds another 50%. The bottom 50% actually have negative wealth because of debt. So the question for me, when people talk about, you know, we have we have to expand the tax base and too few people paying taxes, I think the obvious answer is that too few people pay tax because too few people get a large share of the most of the income and control and have access to almost all the wealth. And so from that perspective, we need to think about redistributive measures, not only to pay for the budget and to increase to be able to bring in a basic income grant, other things, but because we know that South Africa is obscenely unequal, the most unequal country in the world, and that kind of inequality is a huge constraint on the ability to develop and grow your economy in the future. And that is sort of within the development economics literature. There's a very strong argument from across the board. You don't have to be a heterodox economist or, you know, somebody who opposes mainstream economics to say that. I think there's a broad agreement. You read it in IMF documents, in UN documents, and within, you know, within the development economic literature overall. And so I actually think that, you know, the way to go would be to think through what kind of redistributive mechanisms, including a wealth tax, could address this kind of obscene inequality in South African society. Just one more question. I'll leave it to my colleagues because there are a few questions, and I think the question of why people aren't getting services and questions about SRD and BIG are important, and other colleagues in PBI have done really good research and work on this and contributed to the presentation at this point. So I think I'll stop there and pass on to my colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you, Siraj. Kafisa, do you want to come in? Then just like that.
Thank you, Dr. Yankees. I will take Honorable Matasa and Honorable Buthelezi's question on the basic services together. So in terms of communities that are eligible to receive basic services and are not, and the decline in that figure, without being speculative on the correlations of the transition of power and the composition of power, what we do know that is that in addition to the onerous process imposed on poor households to be registered, which is contrary to the policy intervention, what is documented and reported is that the money that is allocated by National Treasury to municipalities to deliver basic services is also not ring-fenced. So there's a leakage and a misallocation of funds where municipalities tend to divert money for delivering basic services that's eligible to households to pay for other things. What we do is that we encourage that mechanisms to hold municipalities accountable be created and implemented so that the funds that are made available for indigent households be used for that purpose. And another answer to that question was actually given by Honorable Buthelezi himself, that the significant reduction in the budget for public work has had an effect on the provision of basic service.
Thank you, Kafi. So, Busi, do you have a point or questions that you want to respond to?
Yes, no, thank you. I want to take the first question that I'll be responding to is about this question about whether disasters have been considered. And I think it's actually a very good question, given that we've had multiple rounds of disasters in South Africa happening. If you look at the flooding, how much flooding has been happening, the droughts over time. And I think it's actually a question that members should be asking National Treasury to say to what extent are the continuous disasters being factored into this into the budgets going forward, but also not that as a PBO previously we tracked the funding that was allocated for the KZN Eastern Cape disasters. And one of the things that we're highlighting is that, yes, money is being allocated when a disaster happens, but to also think about the backlogs, right? So with past disasters, there's been continuous backlogs for housing and so forth. And so allocating new money doesn't always necessarily account for those long-term backlogs. And so what we've said in the past is to say we need to think about what Siraj is speaking about as well is building resilience, right? So building resilience requires us to not only look at
the current disaster in this current moment, but to also look at the backlogs and then look forward as well. So in that one presentation, we actually said we need to be more proactive about disaster responses rather than reactive. So that is in terms of the disaster response. Also just want to add to what my colleague Kagiso was just saying, and to say that, you know, one of the fundamental issues is that the whole local government structure is based on the ability for local governments to also raise their own revenue, which is, you know, we've seen over time the traditionally poor ones might not have the same capacities to raise that revenue. And so it also then leads to what Kagiso was already mentioning, this idea that they reallocate the money that's for indigent households towards other expenditure. So there's a broader issue there. I mean, you know, we can even start with the division of revenue. Is 10% target towards local government sufficient to deliver on the public basic services, which is a big part of the NDP, right? The how we reach what we're trying to reach is all about providing public basic services. And so is that allocation, you know, in terms of the local government sphere, even sufficient to begin with in the greater schemes of the total budget? I also wanted to comment on the SRD to basically say, you know, in one of the, in last year's presentation, the PBO asked, can we afford not to spend more to address the ongoing crises that households face? And so in terms of the SRD, we have never commented on what the level of the SRD should be. But what we have highlighted continuously is that, you know, 350 Rand is not enough. And obviously, as highlighted, inflation has eroded the 350 Rand. But also to highlight here that, you know, in thinking about a UBEG, and we've asked, you know, what would be the measures for the future? What will happen to the people who were receiving the grants and will no longer receive them if not continued in 2025? But I think looking at the research is important. And I think, you know, we've asked Treasury if there's been any assessment, you know, of what the SRD grant has done in the economy. And this a study like that doesn't exist. But Kola and Borat do have a study, and they say that the SRD in 2020 reduced poverty by 5.3% amongst the poorest households and household inequality by 1.3 to 6.3%. So we kind of need to have one, these studies that show us these are the real impacts of what this grant does, and not look at it as a narrow consumption that kind of just goes away, but to think of it as a broader economic stimulus in a way, as Siraj is talking about, how it highlights or how it increases demand in the economy and how it supports households and unpaid care work. And I also want to highlight that, you know, for example, thinking about a basic income grant for more people, thinking about it through a gendered lens, you know, so even if you look at the numbers for the current SRD recipients, you do see that women are disproportionately represented. But that's also because women are disproportionately represented in the unemployment statistics. So thinking about grants, not just as an expenditure item, but really thinking about those economic linkages that, you know, it has and what it means for, you know, in the context of unemployment, poverty and inequality. And just to kind of flag, and this is will be my second last point, but to say, you know, in the Taylor report, the estimates of giving everyone 100 Rand per month, and of course this is 2002, so it's quite long ago, but what they estimated was that it would bring down poverty significantly. And I think if I'm not quoting it incorrectly, it was about 70%. So if our context is about reducing unemployment or rather inequality and poverty significantly, to see the grants as playing a critical role in that. And of course, that's not undermining the other economic development that needs to happen in society. And then the last point in terms of underspending, there are a lot of questions about underspending. And as you know, the PBO has conducted some of these studies. And of course, it is a complex, you know, kind of area to look at. But I think always to highlight, to say, you know, departments underspending because one, they don't have enough allocations to begin with. So that can also lead to underspending. But there are also another variety of reasons and systematic reasons that we have to look at for why underspending is happening. And just to remind members, you know, that cutting the expenditure does not solve the underspending issue. It just takes away the resources that were meant to do something. So we need to be more critical about how do we resolve the underspending issues, the root causes, rather than just cutting the spend away, which does not actually solve the problem, and neither does it provide the services that are required in society. So I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Busi. Lwazikazi, Stanley, do you have any points to add? I think I know Tepo's here as well. Anyone wants to add before I conclude?
Nothing from my side, Dr. Sanchez.
All right. No, thank you so much. Thanks, colleague. Chair, there are some of the points that we wanted to also comment on quickly before I get back to you. And thank once more for the opportunity and the questions. And then there was a question on, again, it's a policy question. Last week on Friday, when the National Assembly was responding to the fiscal summary debate, one of the points that we raised, we reminded members, was the fact that we've had high interest rate, higher short and long-term interest rate over the 28 years drive as economy. And I think particularly compared to some of the other OECD countries in particular, and our concern there to say that high interest rate does impact on investments in business, particularly when you see that the strong evidence that shows that credit extension, business and household does contribute towards investment in the economy. And I think in line with that point was really responding to the question around, say, in any macroeconomic policy reform that would happen over the medium term, some of the really consideration has to be taken, particularly related to monetary policy. I know now I should raise this point, is really thinking and recognizing that economic growth, employment, and income distribution, income inequality, those are macroeconomic variables that if ever we're going to target price stability as one of the important macroeconomic variables, those has to also be taken into account, in particular, say, when you have more targeting some of these areas as well, would be an area that enables government to start dealing particularly employment and growth as well, to say, if our monetary policy is going to target price stability, are we able to also have a clear specific targets for employment and growth in particular as well, as one way of trying to address some of these measures. We've seen that in earlier, but that was taken away in that regard. That's the point I'm going on. The other point, Chair, and I'm glad the colleagues responded to the issue of underspending. So one of the reasons that we saw in our underspending issue was around how much sometimes some of the entities actually rush to underspend because they know that there has been the concern of a need to save. And for me, that is concerning because we need to draw a very good balance between ensuring that there's cutting expenditure, but also not creating a fear from government entities that they don't want to spend because they know that they have been requested to cut spending, whereas services suffers in the process. That's very important balance needs to be drawn, particularly in messaging, because when you hear people say there's austerity, is cutting expenditure, in service delivery mechanisms, in many service delivery points, people feel like it's good to save as opposed to deliver service. And that, again, links back to the point about wage bill. I think we had this conversation debate a lot of times, but maybe we have not had it recently. Honorable Tobias will remember that in previously. But I think for me, the question is that we have seen that there's a more need for more doctors, for more teachers, for more police, and all of that. And for me, wage bill should not be seen in a holistically as the best thing. I think it has to be seen as an investment in also in support for households in particular. But I think the need for service delivery, Chair and members, it really underscores debate around wage bill and what it means. Maybe the framework that is in place, but we need to be careful not to say wage bill as a wage in particular, but it has to be seen as a way of part of service delivery in a broader scheme of things. The DDM model, again, was work done on trial, and we really strongly recommend that the committee invites some of the feedback. There was a lot of uptake, but also there was issue of capacity and issue of how you get that implemented. There was one question I wanted to raise, but I think I'll stop there, Chair, and thank you so much for the opportunity. I don't know if members want to follow up on some of the points. Thank you so much. I've addressed all my points. Thank you so much, Chair and members.
Thank you, Dr. Tranchis. Let me
sorry, there's one point I forgot. I do apologize. I noted here. It was just a few moments. The point I wanted to address was around the duplication. Yes. The duplication. I think one of the areas, there certainly is a lot of duplication, particularly on some programs. But one particular program that we'll be following up a lot over the next few months or so is on public employment. There's so much public employment programs. Maybe what would want to happen is have that being done in a one program as opposed to it being in multiple CS or whatever, but have it centralized in a way that you can have more clear monitoring over it. And it's something that we'll look at, particularly when you look at how much public employment programs are important and how much have they been able to provide support for younger population and so on. So it's a very important program to say, how do you centralize that to ensure that You have many of these programs in a way you're able to gain efficiency, but at the same time, you're able to see the impact of such programs. And it's something that we'll be following up and we'll give a feedback to the committee on this. It also includes the grant as well. So we'll give the feedback. Some of these questions are really more about cost, including visiting Ekurhuleni. Anyway, thank you so much. And we're glad that the appropriations committee that recommends that to give us more funds for that. Thank you so much, members. Thank you.
Doc and the team, thank you very much. But before I let you go, let me check with Honorable Tobias. Honorable Tobias, anything of any follow-up? And remember, it's your last day with the PBO. Remember, so anything which is troubling you? Honorable Tobias, let me start with you.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, the comment I made on the wage bill is taken out of context because the reason why I wanted us to talk to the slide that spoke about what is the gist of the matter, it was about whether are we achieving our targeted goals or not. Because you juxtapose that to what you are paying for. So if you are going to pay for a labor that did not achieve, and you are using funds, this kind of funds, to me, it will remain a worry. Because it's not like you are using your normal budget to deal with these issues. You implement a particular approach with your invested funds that are reserves to deal with that. And I'm not saying there's anything inherently wrong with it, increasing your wage bill. It should be based on the productivity levels and addressing the very same things that Dr. Jankis is raising, addressing the shortages of certain sectors that are important, your doctors, your teachers, and so on. So it's a debate for another day, but I wanted to clear that so that it was not saying you should not do that. I was comparing it with having to go to the extent of using your reserves, and yet we are not even achieving the goals. In relation to the issue that has been responded to on the DPME, I don't think we have adequate time to engage that. Because it is clear that certain departments have taken mandates that they will never be able to implement on. And I don't think we have adequate time to go to the current performance of the DPME and how it has. I can even speak about the service that is in the presidency in relation to the complaining that they have not been achieving the implementation thereof. Because if you have that unit that receives complaints from the public, but it still needs to refer that to other departments, and it's going to depend on those departments to implement, another debate. So basically, I wanted to clear that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Tobias. Honorable Zana, anything? SS Fubeni. Before we let PBO leave.
Sorry, Honorable Chair. I'm not sure if I misunderstand Honorable Tobias.
Doc.
Yes, sir.
Just hold your horses.
Sorry.
I'll give you a chance to.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Honorable Zana, anything? Honorable Matafa? Honorable Memezi?
Chairperson.
Honorable Zana, you want to say something?
Chairperson, sorry. My gadget is delaying. I'm trying to multitask, though it's hitting on me. Otherwise, okay. I'm fine.
Thank you, Honorable Mlenzana. Honorable Matafa, anything from your side? Honorable Memezi, anything from your side? Honorable Taiso, anything from your side? Okay. Okay, from my... Rumemezi, are you covered?
I'm covered, Chair.
Okay, thank you. I think from my side, I've specifically referred to certain slides, Dr. Nelia. I spoke about slide 30, and I just said, please, can you talk to that slide? Exactly, there was a point that you were making, which was indicating that there's a change the way the LGS is being dealt with. That's one. Just look at that. Let me see. Yeah, there's this question I didn't ask, and I think this the National Treasury through the budget, they wanted to get to the primary balance. I think in the current or in the next fiscal year. So my question, would like to hear, please reflect on it, Dr. Chanchis and the team. I'm saying, aren't they too aggressive in the attainment of this primary balance? And from your side, what do you think the costs are? The opportunity cost of let me say my hypothesis from where I am, I think they're too aggressive, but I would like to hear your view. Dr. Chanchis and the team?
Thank you, Chair. I know I noted that Dr. Siraj Mohammed wanted to come in. I'll just give him and Madam Sibek as well. Siraj, you want to come in and talk to those points, and I'll take whatever will be remaining. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So, sorry I butted in earlier, Honorable Chair. I thought you were moving on from our from the questions.
No problem.
What I thought was, I wasn't sure if I was understanding Honorable Tobias properly, but she seems to be indicating that the Chifeka money would be used towards paying the wage bill. And my understanding from reading the documents, both Treasury documents and Reserve Bank documents, or Reserve Bank explanation, is that it will go that all of it will go towards paying down towards the debt. So that was the one thing I wanted to clarify. I think you know, the view that we've been presenting over a while in terms of, you know, was that we don't think that trying to achieve a surplus is necessary the right kind of fiscal policy approach for a developing country, particularly a developing country like South Africa, because there is so much need, and there's so much development in terms of addressing that need, but also in terms of building the, you know, the engine of growth of the economy, building the infrastructure, you know, deepening and diversifying our industrial base, and those aspects, and the government looking at the way in which finance is being allocated, and the kind of investment we've had over the last 3 decades or so, we see a need for that for a strong active developmental state to play a large role in supporting and working with the private sector in getting towards that new growth path and that kind of economic development. And through that process, you know, we can bring investment, employment, which we can actually then reduce the need for grants. People who work have less of a need for you know, grants. They can also take care of a lot more of their basic services, but also the government can then enhance basic services, like China's built a high-speed network of rail. They don't say, you know, we've increased the social wage by so much percentage. They basically see this as a benefit not only for households but the whole economy, because people can move to their jobs and to do other kinds of economic activities much faster, much more efficiently, and it also, you know, deals with urban space and all those kinds of issues. So we need a kind of broader perspective, I believe, and that That means that we've always, for many developing countries like ourselves, you know, it seems like we've always will have an investment to make, and it doesn't necessarily make sense for us to try to push to achieve a surplus. And the idea of getting a surplus is just to reduce the debt levels. And overall, I think what our aim should be is to achieve a level of development and growth where the debt doesn't necessarily decrease, but the GDP increases to achieve that. And then, okay, let me stop there and move on, because I think you had an important question for Nelia. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Raj. Nelia, do you want to put the slide back up? Mukund, put the slide back for Nelia, please, before Busi comes back. Dr. Landis?
I actually also think, Honorable Patelezi, is it slide 8 or slide 28?
The one that shows the difference.
That's what, yeah. That's what I'll tell you.
Slide 28.
Yeah, it talks about the local government equity share and the changes that have taken place there.
Oh, it's 30, slide 30?
Yeah, slide 30. 30,
I think,
yeah, slide
30.
Yeah. Yeah, and so members, I really thought this was a very good illustration in the budget review that Treasury actually included. So I always actually wanted to do this exercise, but I never did it. And I think this kind of illustration, in terms of adding the revenue of the local government as well into this equation. I think for the following years, I think we should continue doing it so one can actually also see the changes over time. So in the second diagram, the Treasury actually just added the local government revenue to the bigger pot, and then they calculated the proportions in terms of the allocation. So I just thought that was very interesting, and it was something that I always wanted to do, but I never did it. But in future, I think one should continue also including the illustration in terms of adding the revenue collected by local government. So that's actually all that I wanted to indicate to members, that it's a different way of showing it, but I think it's very interesting, and it's worth continue with that illustration of the division of revenue.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Landi. Busi, do you want to come in? Your point there?
Yes. I just earlier on when I was responding about the SRD, I had missed one point, which I think is very important for these committees to ask, which is the question of, do the number of beneficiaries determine how much Treasury should allocate, or does Treasury allocate and then the number of beneficiaries then decided on the allocation? And so what we've seen happen is that there's been an allocation which has then determined the beneficiaries, as opposed to saying how many people should, you know, the target group, DSD said the target group is 10.9 million people. So what we should have been seeing is that the allocation should have matched the beneficiaries. So I think one of the critical questions this committee must take up in terms of the SRD grants is, you know, to ask this question, which one should come first, beneficiaries first, allocation first? And we've seen allocation first, which has meant a number of beneficiaries have not actually received the grants as a result of the allocation, you know, preceding the number of people that identified as needing. But also just wanted to add to what Suraj was saying earlier about this budget surplus, and to say, you know, the reason why we do the real per capita analysis is to really show what the effects of the budget cuts or consolidation are on in terms of real expenditure. And I think to think of it in terms of this, to say, you know, the budget, primary budget surplus is a short-term win in terms of markets and debt and so forth, but it has real long-term costs. So, you know, a lot of the literature on kind of this approach to fiscal policy shows that, you know, austerity has exacerbated existing inequalities. And in our response to the committees last year, we wrote a whole small response about what austerity is and what its impacts are, and also the international evidence around this. And so to not underestimate what this quote-unquote short-term win means
for the long-term costs. And I'll give one example. In the UK, the UK is one of the countries that has been lauded for using austerity to come back to a better fiscal balance. But what actually, when you look at the numbers, you realize that the inequality deepened, and it particularly deepened in terms of income. The distribution of income was worse off 10 years after the austerity program than it was when they implemented it, but also not just on those terms, on a gendered term, in terms of the marginalized communities. They were worse off, but the budgets looked better to the markets, but the real people were the ones suffering. And the last example is in Greece, where they cut a program, a needle exchange program. And what that meant is that they had like an over 50% increase in the number of people infected by HIV and AIDS. And so you can imagine the long-term costs of having to now provide healthcare for those people as opposed to paying for the preventative care today. So I think those are the terms in which we need to think about budget surplus or primary budget surpluses, which is what are we foregoing today, which will make the markets happy because the South Africa will have a great balance sheet. But at the same time, what are the real human costs that we need to take into account? That's all from my end. Thank you.
Thank you so much, colleagues, and thank you so much, Chair. I think
it's
my last.
Sorry, if I may interject again, I'm sorry. I was going through the questions and I realized, I spoke about Chief Tektrov first in the previous round and I forgot to answer a question by Honorable Kayiso. If there's time and the Chair will permit, if I can go in.
Please continue, Dr. Raj.
Yes, thank you. So, Honorable Kayiso made the point that, I'm just reading my notes again. There should be a framework in the future for guiding the use of the possibility of funds flowing to National Treasury. And I think it's important to point out, as we do in our presentation, that, this waterfall of into three pools creates a system of sort of guarding against, the possibility that government and National Treasury will go to GFECTRA if there is an, if it shows, bigger reserve again. And it sort of sets out saying, well, first we need to make sure that the actual reserve is a certain size. And then the second pool is to say, well, we're going to cover the subs so that isn't exposed. And the subs also decided that they can increase reserves, so they'll be paying interest to the banks, which we are a bit concerned about. And then finally, if there's anything left, that will go into the final pool, and that would be distributed to the National Treasury. Now, given the current situation, it's not likely that that's going to be a lot of money for a while. So I agree that perhaps there should be a framework for that, but I don't think we should necessarily, we're looking at the 100 billion and then 25 billion in the next 2 years. I don't think we should expect to see those large numbers. And that's also why we say the use of GFECTRA points to the need to look at then other parts of government's balance sheet that possibly creates that where there is space where we can actually then augment the budget and use that for the kind of spending the economy needs and possibly also for reducing debt levels. Thank you.
Thank you so much, colleagues. Chair, before I give back to you, I just also want to thank the committee so much. I know it's our last meeting with the committee. So much for the very great guidance that you gave us to the committee over the few years. And really, indicate that the office has really grown over time and learned a lot from the members. And we're really hoping to continue working closely well with the appropriate committee in future. And we really thank for the opportunity in this regard. Thank you so much, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Doc, and thank you for the engagement. Let me once again thank you, Dr. Janchis, Dr. Siraj, Dr. Nelia, Kagiso, Lwazikazi, Busi, Thembiso, and all the PBO family for having engaged with us for the past 5 years. We've been together in one shape or the other. And I must say that we've always engaged, and I personally, and I think I'm talking for the committee, we've also enjoyed the interaction. Economics is not a natural science. There are many views on the same issue. It's unlike natural science, where two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom is what you can't change it. 1 + 1 = 2. That's it. But in economics, it doesn't work that way. If there's nothing you want to take away, if there's nothing else you want to take away from me today, correctly saying, Doc, this is our last meeting in this administration. I always try to stress this, that economics is not a politically neutral social science. It's not very much class orientated. Out there, we know there are left wing economists, there are right wing economists. So you may choose where you place yourself, and you don't just go there blind and say, because it's economics, it should be neutral. It's very much a class bias. You would see in some instances the way our trade policies generally in the world, the fiscal policies, the monetary policies, will reflect the dominant class at a particular time, dominant class or dominant stratum. So that's, I just want, especially with the budding economists who may be listening to us and who are here on the platform. So as to who we are going, you read, and I prefer to read everybody else, whether you want to read Milton Friedman or you want to read Keynes, it says something. So for me, I'm just saying that's very important to know exactly which interest you are serving with a particular point that you are taking as far as these policies are concerned. But Doctor, as I said, and with the team, we've enjoyed every minute with you. We need not agree on everything that you said, but there's no doubt that after having interacted, we all come out of those interactions wiser. So we should continue to that. We've raised a number of things as this committee, Sixth Administration Standing Committee on Appropriations, and I'll be lying if I say that we've done everything that we wanted to do, but I think there has been progress that we reached, and I think you need to work on that progress. Let not the seventh administration start from scratch as you do the orientation and so on. You will have to raise these things that you have discussed with us. So you carry those things forward. Yeah, thank you very much, and wishing a PPO. I also know that the permanent PPO was appointed during our tenure. Good luck, Dr. Chanchis and the team as you move forward. Your task is a very important one. I also know that there's always a complaint about the resources, and I agree with you. When we went to South Korea and interacted with their counterparts, we saw how well-resourced they are. But that's not an event. Continue working on that. Honourable members, thank you so much for having interacted with PPO the way you have interacted. This brings us to the end of this agenda item. PPO, you may decide to remain with us, or you may want to go out and do work, but even remaining in the meeting, it will still be part of your work. This takes care of this, and it's on behalf of the committee. Okay, thank you
so much. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it, Chairperson. Thank you.
Perfect.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, guys. Let's go to the next agenda item, honorable members, and these are the minutes. Let me see. Honorable members, we have got the minutes of the 14th of February. That's how diligent you are. Even on the 14th of February, you come to the meetings. Do I have the mover for the adoption of the minutes of the 14th of February 2024?
Matafa moves, Chair.
Honorable Matafa moves. Seconder.
Memezi second, Chair.
Memezi second. The minutes of the 14th of February 2024 are duly adopted. Can we go to the minutes of the 27th of February? Mover?
Memezi moves, Chair.
Memezi moves. Second down. Come again. Who second? Or Maria seconds. Thank you. So the minutes of the 27th of February 2024 are duly adopted. That takes care of agenda item number 5. Can we go to the announcements and correspondence, if any, Darren?
Chairperson, thank you. Just a reminder about tomorrow's meeting with the FFC. This will be a physical meeting in Parliament. Venue is S35, first floor NCOP building. The meeting will start at 9 o'clock. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. That's noted, Darren. See you tomorrow, oral members and colleagues from the support staff. We haven't seen each other for a long time, so let's meet tomorrow at S35 NCOP building. This takes us to the end of this meeting. As I said, today it was our last interaction with the PBO, so the meeting is adjourned.
Long live the chair.
Recording stopped.